Welcome to the SAG-AFTRA Foundation's Conversations podcast. The SAG-AFTRA Foundation believes that contributions made to our culture by performing arts are not only valuable, but also essential. And so we provide free programming and services like this podcast to support them. If you'd like to learn more about the SAG-AFTRA Foundation or access the full library of our conversations or make a donation to support this podcast, please visit sagaftra.foundation. That's www.sagaftra.foundation. Also, subscribe to our YouTube channel and follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at SAG-AFTRA-Found. Thanks, and enjoy the conversation.
Well, I don't really need to introduce him. I'm Stacey Wilson Hunt from the Hollywood. It's not the Hollywood Reporter. I don't work. See, you got me all. You messed up my flow. Stacey Wilson Hunt from New York Magazine and Vulture. Very nice to be here. Thank you, sir, for being here. Obviously, there's a swell of interest and fandom in the room. So I think we're all feeling honored on a Monday, getting back into the week to be able to talk to you about your incredible career. First, I want to know, what was your life like growing up in New Jersey?
Just typical suburbs, sports. That's all we did. If it was football season, we play soccer because I was way too skinny for football. Basketball was, I was a gym rat for years from seventh grade up through high school. Baseball, until I got hit a couple times with the baseball, then I gave up that. But it was just, you know, swim clubs in the summertime, school, sports.
Were your parents artistic at all? Did they have interest in Hollywood or acting or in the arts?
No, but my sister's very dramatic. But no, my parents were involved in politics. Okay. So in a
sense.
They both
ran for office, yes?
Yeah.
And what did you learn about the world from them? Were they optimistic people about politics? Did they want to come in and help people? Were they humanitarians?
Yeah, they were Democrats who believed in helping, and it's just a brutal business. It's almost as bad as this one.
Very similar in a lot of ways.
I saw my mother's heart get broken a few times. You know, people say that they want. To help her run for office, and then they turn and they go to somebody else. So to this day, I'm still a little hesitant of it.
And when was the first time you performed or felt artistic as an actor, or maybe you wrote something, or you felt that you wanted to express yourself?
Well, in sixth grade, Alan Rowland got sick. So I had to take over his part in the music that we were singing. We're singing a bunch of songs. In camp, I played Fagin in Oliver. And then in my high school year, I quit basketball, and the drama teacher, I took drama as an elective, asked me to be in the play, to audition for it. It was Sunday in New York, and I hated it. I hated everything about it. And then it came time to go to college, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And my dad said, go wherever you want, take whatever you want. So I walked out of my SATs. I'm 62, so I walked out of my SATs. But I got into the University of Miami because at that time in 1973, you just needed a pulse to get in there. So I got in, and I was just going to take liberal arts. So I'm in line for liberal arts, and I got up front of the line. They said, you had to take math and history. I said, exactly. That was my reaction.
This exactly. Wasn't what I signed up for.
So right next to it was for the drama department. So I took a step over and said, I'll be a drama major. My dad said, take whatever you want. And then this girl, she said, "You going out for the play tonight?" It was, I didn't even know there was a play. I didn't want to be an actor. I just didn't want to take math or history. And I said no, and she berated me. I mean, she was really upset by the fact that I wasn't going to do it. So I went, and I had the audition, and it was for Cabaret. So just a quick story. So what you had to do is you had to tell a sad story. So I was on the phone in sixth grade with Bobby Zimbardo because we had a little a band that we sang like one song, "Don't Walk Away, Renee," or something like that. We had a Dalmatian that was just a pain. I opened the door. I didn't feel like walking him out. All of a sudden, I hear screeching and noise, and then the dog yelping. See, yeah. Sad story.
Very sad, yeah.
And so I got a call back. I then had to sing and dance. And now, like, I'm a jock from Jersey, and I remember my parents... They took us to see the original Pippin. And I remember this one song, "Magic to Do," which was just a really great song, but for somebody else to sing it, not me. But so I went, and then the girl Valerie, she helped me. She got the sheet music, and okay, I think I know this. And then I went to give it to the very bitchy piano player. and I took it from him. He says, "What are you doing?" I says, "Well, I have to say it, don't I?" I didn't know you had to have it memorized.
Oh, no.
So he said, "Well, I got to play it. I don't know it. Just do whatever you can." So all I remembered was the refrain. "We got magic to do. We got magic." And they're saying you're supposed to be singing with it. So all I remembered, like, I don't know how, remember Freddie and the Dreamers, that group, right? Well, they had the song. So I'm singing with "They Got Magic to Do," and then I'm doing the Freddie, which is this. "You got magic." And that was the Freddie, because it was more of a kid group. And I got the part.
Wow. Auspicious beginnings. So after college, you moved to New York right away, it sounds like.
Yeah, once there was an acting teacher, his name was Buckets. And they called him that because he played basketball, put the ball in the bucket. So I could relate to him. And I was different for him because I wasn't somebody who was, you know, wanted to do this since they were little. I just had a different personality, being more aggressive and jockey, and he liked that. So he kind of took me under his wing, and I started getting really nice parts. And I said, "Well, I think I'm going to stay and do this a little more." And I ended up staying for the 4 years. And then I moved to New York. And the third day I was in New York, I got a commercial. And it was for KTEL Records, "Love Songs of the 50s. And all really, they just was me and a girl walking in the park, and it was stills, and then they were supposed to play the love songs of the 50s, but I think nobody really fell in love in the 50s because the commercial just disappeared, so nothing happened to it.
Like, at what point were you at what point were you cast in Another World?
That was...
Like, how long into your tenure in New
6
York?
Months from graduating college.
Wow, that's a big deal.
It was really the first month I was flown out here because Robert Zemeckis was doing, I think it was called Beatles Forever, or it was something about a group of kids trying to get into the Plaza when the Beatles were there. But I didn't get in there, but I got into the soap. And when I started into the acting in the 70s, the only movies that I ever saw were Clint Eastwood movies, the Beatles movies, or whatever my parents took me to. When movies were movies, when there were intermissions and the movies were huge and just, and the screens and everything, but I still didn't want to do it. I was so naive. I really thought they were killing people on screen. It was so real to me that, but I never thought like about that you could do it.
You were an intense fan more so than someone who wanted to.
Yeah, I was impressed. So, but I got the soap.
He played Joey Perini. Yeah. I assume he was a bad boy Italian guy.
No. The nicest character in the
really?
World.
Really? Oh.
Yeah. Me, Ray, I've never been in a fight in my life. So my friends laugh at the parts that I play because they know that I'm not, you know, anything close to.
And did you find, and a lot of great actors started on soaps, Alec Baldwin, Julianne Moore. It was a great vehicle back then for people who really wanted to do good work. Not to say it's not today, it's just a different business now. What kind of exposure did you get from that arc? I think it was 8 episodes, is that true? On the soap?
No, I did 3.5 years.
Oh, you did 3.5 years. Okay. My information is incorrect. Did you find yourself getting auditions for movies from the exposure on the show?
There was one thing. If the story is true, Sandra Locke, who used to go with Clint Eastwood, watched the soap. And they came and they were interested in me for, I forgot the name of the movie, but it didn't work out because of scheduling. And I got a movie of the week. Movie of the weeks were big back then. And I did a movie of the week with Michael Paré and David Caruso and Amy Madigan. And then went back to the soap. Then when I was 25, 26, I quit the soap because I wanted to come out and I wanted to try to get into movies. Because like when I first started, like I said, I didn't used to go to movies. So in the 70s, I graduated high school in 73. And the 70s, as you all know, was a great, great period of movie making. And that's what my influences were. So that's what I wanted to be like. That's who I wanted to work with. And I've been lucky enough to work with a lot of those people that I just would drool over, like Gene Hackman and Robert Duvall and Pacino, De Niro, all these people. I've been really lucky.
So you come, so the soap filmed in New York, and so then you moved to L.A. after?
Right. After, okay. I moved to L.A. and right into a struggling actor's box.
Okay. So the soap really didn't necessarily negate you having to go through the struggles of the L.A. actor lifestyle.
Oh, no. I went through the struggles. Luckily, my parents, my dad was good with handling money, so he made my soap money last for 5 years. But again, I was still in, like, it was pretty much this size, my apartment. That brown shag carpeting, and it was horrible. It was on Beechwood, but it was five buildings up from the school on Beechwood. 1970 Beechwood Drive.
And when you auditioned, did you find yourself getting consistent feedback from casting directors about, you know, certain roles they saw you as, certain roles they didn't see you playing? Did you have to fight against typecasting
at all? No, I mostly heard no.
Okay.
There was a few. I got a series, but the series that David Wolper produced it, but it was based off of Casablanca. So they had David Saul from Starsky and Hutch as the Humphrey Bogart part. Scatman Crothers was Sam, and I was Sasha the bartender, who just served a drink every now and then. And then I did a guest shot on a show called The Mississippi that Ralph Waite had done. And then my money started running out, and then I got Something Wild through Melanie, who was married to Stephen Bauer, who was Al Pacino's best friend in Scarface. And it was my parents' involvement in politics that made me call. They said, just call Melanie up. Maybe she'll help you get in, you know. And I said, no, I got to do it. I'm going to audition and I'm going to get it my way. And I'm sitting there saying, my way's not working.
You're trying to be a good guy about it.
So I called up Melanie and Jonathan, God rest his soul, he just passed away, said, Melanie, please, I have it down to three people. It's been a really, really tough process. And she said, Jonathan, you told me that she had a bad experience with an actor. So she wanted some say-so on who was going to play her husband.
And was Jeff Daniels already attached at that point?
Jeff was attached and Melanie was attached. So Jonathan did, you know, was down to three guys for the part that I eventually played. So she got me in just because I think she just wanted to let Jonathan know that you gave her that power and she was going to take it. I don't know if it was belief in me. I think she just wanted to use her power. So on Monday I met I maybe just met Jonathan. I said, all right, if I'm going to get turned down now after 5 years, I'll get turned down. But at least I met the director and let him say it. Tuesday, I get a call. They say they wanted me to come in and read with another actor. So they hired an actor or asked an actress to come in to read some of the parts that were Melanie's. I said, all right, now if I'm going to get turned down, at least I got up and I talked and acted and let that happen. Thursday comes around and they say they want you to come in tomorrow to read with Jeff Daniels. So I'm so excited. And I remember I was watching Johnny Carson. And who's on Johnny Carson talking about Woody Allen because he just did the Purple Rose of Cairo and Jack Nicholson because he just did Terms of Endearment, but Jeff Daniels. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, my God, I got to work with this guy tomorrow. So I started doing push-ups. I'm like looking at the script and I'm doing push-ups. And I'm like, oh, and Woody did this and oh, Jack was this and Shirley MacLaine. And I'm like, oh man. So
did you say I was Joey Perini on Another World? I mean, come on.
No, that didn't work. But I went and I had throughout when I as soon as I moved to LA. Stephen and Melanie turned me on to this acting teacher, Harry Mastro George, who I stayed with for 12 years. Even when I started making movies, I would go right back to class to work with them through Goodfellas, through Field of Dreams, back to class. And so I did the scene with Jeff and, then I get another call. Jonathan wants to meet with you. Before he goes back to New York. So we met at Hugo's on Santa Monica Boulevard. And, I went and he said, look, you know, as you know, you've been coming here now for a while. I gotta go back. There were three other people who were in the mix and I'm gonna go and I'll know by the middle of the week. So the middle of the week to me is Monday. But then Tuesday came and there's nothing. And literally the middle of the week, Wednesday came and there was nothing. And I said, oh man. And then Thursday came, I can get emotional now. I remember he said, Ray, would you like to be Ray? And I broke down. I just got really, I could get emotional now thinking about it. It really, really, after struggling and, you know, whenever I talk or do these things, I really do it for the people who break hasn't come or who hasn't gotten their shot, that it might not happen at the time you want it to happen, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's not going to happen. It's just a matter of you know, when it does. But that's how the first, what did that had nothing to do with what you asked me.
Hey, this is your show. This is your day, and we're honored for you to share those moments with us, because I'm sure everyone in this room can relate to what you just said. So a couple years after Something Wild was Field of Dreams, which is such
I did a movie, Dominic and Eugene, in between, which was really, really, Tom Hulce was unbelievable. Yes.
He was
great.
Incredible. And that was shortly after Amadeus.
Yeah.
I think he had just broken up.
But that was with just bad luck. That was with Orion, too. So it was something wild. But they put together great movies and stuff. It's the marketing was a little. And then we faced, it was the same time that Rain Man came out. So, and that was, you know, but.
Hard to beat that one. And so when you first read the script for Field of Dreams, which is such an odd, sweet little movie, we think about what a big deal this movie became. But at the time, I imagine it was kind of a hard sell on the director's part to just like, it's this field and there's this like dead baseball player living in it and he comes out. And I mean, it's a really dreamy sort of beautiful
story. I thought it was
the
dumbest script I ever read. I did. I couldn't understand why this guy would plow up his cornfield for like this ghost, because I wasn't movie savvy and hadn't seen really a lot of movies up to that point. The ones I did were in the 70s. They would have shot up the cornfield, but not made it into a baseball field. So
it was a little bit more sentimental than the movies you were used to seeing. Well, what sold you on wanting to play Shoeless Joe Jackson?
They asked me.
So you were able to set aside your feelings about the story too for the opportunity.
No, I said if they'll plow it up, I'll play on it.
If they plow
it's his money, not mine.
If they plow it, you will come, which you did. Sorry, I had to get
you're going to have a lot of dates after that one.
My parents watch these, you guys.
Now they know.
So that offers a perfect segue to Goodfellas. Scorsese said that he loved your, quote, explosive energy from Something Wild. And that's what really caught his notice with you. Do you remember your first meeting with him? Did you have a long audition process for Murray Hill?
Yeah. The very first, I'd been with every alphabet agent there is. with ICM, then the CAA, and at that time,
I've never heard
I was with CAA, and I think Marty was there too, and I've heard varying stories about how I got it. But I heard that Bob had mentioned me at a party to Marty, and that's actually how it happened. But I took my dad. Dominic and Eugene was at the Venice Film Festival, and we were at the Excelsior Hotel on the second floor, looking down at just all the like people, and you know, film festivals are, there are some characters. So I was just watching everything that was going on. And all of a sudden there was this big commotion. And I look in the middle of it is Marty. And I hadn't talked to him in like 2 or 3 months because he went and did Last Temptation of Christ. And that was there, but he was getting a lot of threats because of the subject matter. So there were a lot of bodyguards. So I said, Dad, I just got to put my face in front of him so he remembers me. So I ran down and I'm starting running towards Marty. And luckily there was a space and the bodyguards, they came after me. And I said, no. I just want to say hi to Marty. That's all I want to do. And he said it was then that he decided that he was going to cast me in it because if you see something wild, you see that I'm just nuts. but Henry Hill was more, no, I'm quiet. The only way Henry got to do everything that he did was because he was just a good soldier, kept his mouth shut, did whatever they asked. So my no, don't hurt me was really what Henry would have been. And he said it was then that he realized.
Wow, that's incredible. So. And how much improv do you remember being able to do on the set? Like the scene we just saw, obviously the clown scene. Was there any improv in that scene? And how many takes did it take to get to what we ended up seeing on screen?
The great thing when you're Martin Scorsese is you get to rehearse. And we had 2 weeks of rehearsal. And sitting around rehearsal with Joe Pesci is fun because he's got lots of stories, and one of the stories that he was telling us was how he was at a restaurant and that happened to him. True to life, real wise guy made him laugh, and he said, well, that's really funny. And the guy, he said, just turned on him. And it was like, whoa. So Marty said, wow, wait, we could use that, because he's always thinking. It's just, there's nothing more exhilarating than to be around somebody who is that passionate about playing make-believe. And originally, the scene would have, in the script, the scene would have been when the guy comes over and says, Tommy asked for a drink, and the guy says, hey, you haven't paid me in a while, and he takes it at your mutt and hits him on the head with the glass. But before, so Marty thought, we'll put it there. Well, what we did was, so he said, that's a really interesting idea. Let's work something out. So Joe and I just started, from scratch. Just, he was telling a story. And then I said, I just came with you. You're a funny guy. And he turned on me. And then we did it a few more times. And Marty had some suggestions and Joe had some suggestions. And then Marty's assistant then wrote it all down because there is improving, but because of the way Marty moves the camera, it moves at certain places. It's like a dance with what you're saying and how the camera's moving. So it has to be at a certain point when you're saying a certain thing. And I'll never forget that our first take of doing it, Joe improv during it. And I remember Marty he got really upset. And he said, let's stick to what we wrote. This is a scene now. So we improv'd, but it was now a scene. So we did it once and then we did it again. And then you just showed that one, right? So when I say, he said something and I said, you really are a funny guy. That was improv-ing within the scripted improv. And then he said, if you're ever in court, you're going to crack. And that just made me laugh. And, a lot of people say about the laugh, but I'm sure everybody here has had a few laughs, and your laugh is a lot different when you're drunk. So
you have a great menacing laugh, though. It's funny, but it's also kind of scary where something could switch very quickly. And that's why you're here today.
Tell me.
That's why you're here today.
I'm a funny guy.
You're a very funny guy. And what did you learn about acting from working with Scorsese that you've carried with you?
Oof. Jesus, you're trying to make me cry. During the filming of this, My mom had cancer during the filming of Goodfellas. So it just made me see this is life and death, and I'm, you know, who, like Marty and Bob, who, like, this is my mother's, like, dying, and died in the middle of it. So the biggest thing that it got me is, like, I remember I did a movie with Gene Hackman, and I never had any scenes with him, but I would go down and sneak and watch him. The same thing with Robert Duvall. And they make mistakes. They flub their lines. They miss, you know, it's like the legends all of a sudden became actors. And the biggest thing during that is, I remember when we were doing the 2-week rehearsal with Bob, you know, he would come up with an idea, and I went, are you serious? Really? You know, Bob came up with that. I don't think that's going to work, buddy. but you have a freedom to try and do whatever. So the biggest thing with that was, one, the excitement, just the sheer excitement that Marty had.
And the environment he created for you to be able to
You could climb to the tallest building and fall, and you knew he was going to catch you. It's a great feeling to have, and it's really exhilarating, like I said, to be and to work with somebody who is so passionate about make-believe.
Yeah. And about acting, too, specifically.
Yeah, all of it, yeah.
And how did your life change when the movie came out?
At first, not at all, because it really wasn't a big, huge
blockbuster.
Right. And I don't even think blockbusters were invented until Jaws. Really, Jaws was the first $100 million movie, and that's when that became the magic, right? Isn't that right? And that's when they all started reaching for that ring, and that's changed things.
And at the time, it was Schwarzenegger movies, it was Bruce Willis. I mean, you were, you know,
yeah, that
you made was an art
started.
Film compared to a lot of what we were seeing in theaters at that time.
Right, and people didn't know what to make of it. It's just been over the past 25 years that it's taken on. Like, I'll have, like, 13, 14-year-old kids coming up to me, you know, saying, oh, my gosh, I just saw Goodfellas. I'm saying, what kind of parents do you have? It's like, it's too young. You're like, 13, 14 years old.
That's
like,
very
be 50. But it does. It's taken on a life of its own.
And you knew the real Henry Hill. Is that true? You
had no.
Spent, oh, you didn't.
I met him after.
Oh, you met him after. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he called me up. He called me up, and he literally said on the phone. No, he said, "I'd like to meet you." I said, "Oh, okay." So we met at Jerry's Deli, where the bowling alley is on Ventura Boulevard, and he was there with his brother, who, if just looked menacing. But the thing that Henry said was like, thanks for not making me look like a scumbag. And I said, did you see the movie? Everything that he did was, you know, cheating on his wife. He was selling drugs, abusing drugs, beating people up. He was like, that's scummy in my neighborhood.
Well, you played him with heart, I guess, is probably what he was saying.
Yeah, no, he did, yeah. He was actually really sweet about it.
And did you see a shift in your career after Goodfellas? Did you start to get different roles? Did you feel like you had heightened exposure?
Well, I was, you know, you do a few. I was like the guy for a second, but I was a guy, and even in the 90s, it was different, and I thought it was about acting and not like branding. And there really is and the actors now are smarter about their branding, because the first thing I wanted to do something totally different than Goodfellas, and so I got a movie where I played a heart surgeon. It was about the VA system, but as luck would have it, Orion went bankrupt just as they were the movie was getting ready to come out. But I wanted to try to do as many different parts as I could. Now I'll play killer after killer after killer. But back then, I really thought it was important because, you know, you really heard about typecasting. That's why I waited a year after Something Wild to do Dominic and Eugene, because it was such a sweet, nice, nice movie. So,
one of my favorite movies is Copland, you were in 1997. So good. I went back and researched, and the budget was only $15 million. I didn't realize it was that small of a budget to have all those incredible actors in one movie. What do you remember about making that movie that has stuck with you?
The biggest thing I remember is a story that Jim Mangold told me. And it was the first time that Bob and Harvey had worked together since Taxi Driver. And he said they spent all day. So Bob would say, "Oh, I think I would go over to the window over here." And then Harvey would say, "No, I'm the captain. I really think I would get to the window first." And they spent the whole day like jockeying for who would do what or who would drink the water first. And they said they didn't shoot one frame of film.
This is 20 years after Taxi Driver at this point.
Yeah, well, yeah, they were competitive, I guess.
So you're not
upset
that day.
That's what I remember the most. Aside from that, it was working with these guys. And it was really becoming friendly with Sly. He's a really, really funny guy. And he would lead. As soon as people saw him, he would right away say, I'm fat because I'm doing a movie. He just couldn't allow himself.
He was 40 pounds heavier.
Yeah.
And that was a big comeback vehicle for him because he hadn't really done anything kind of smaller.
And he was really good in it. I thought he was really good in it.
I agree. So I watched a clip from this next film I want to talk about recently, and I don't know why I put myself through it because I watched it late at night, but the scene at the dinner table in Hannibal with your brain exposed is one of the most disturbing things I've ever seen in my life, and yet I forced myself to watch it. What was it like to work with Ridley Scott on that?
It was great. He's another one who had such passion about playing make-believe. But I remember asking him, saying, "How are we going to do this? He said, "I don't know." So I'm not sure myself. So I just figured I did some research and didn't realize that when you do brain surgery, you're awake, because I guess they have to touch certain areas and your response is what it's supposed to be or not what it's supposed to be. And so I just figured the drug that Anthony gave me just made me silly and goofy. And that's how he did it. But I remember when I saw it, like, I got sick.
I can't imagine seeing a scene
brutal.
Like that. And do you generally watch your movies? Do you?
No, I haven't seen over 3/4 of them.
Really?
Yeah.
That you just don't enjoy seeing yourself on screen?
That I don't, for me in particular, God bless you, did someone just sneeze? I'm not sure I could be objective enough to, you know, the experience is supposed to be the experience you're having, not the experience you're watching as an actor. So I didn't want, because there's some actors, you know, that they watch themselves, because when they're on screen, their head is tilted just the way they like it. It's true, though.
So they're already thinking about the result.
I don't want to have any preconceived anythings where, so.
That head tilt looked familiar, but I won't guess who it might be. One of my favorite performances was on ER in 2004, for which you won an Emmy playing Charlie Metcalf. Do you guys remember that episode? It's just grueling, but very beautiful. What was it like to to inhabit that character. I know it was you weren't on the show for very long, but it was really wrenching, especially someone who's at the end of his life. What was it like to envelop that? It must have been tough.
It was brutal because I, like many people, I'm scared shitless of dying. And the whole thing was dealing with, I know I'm dying. So, and then to have a relationship or not a relationship with my child, which is like kind of the same thing in Shades. It just puts you in a weird head. It wasn't a pleasant place to think of and to be, to not have a relationship with somebody because of some stupid ego reason that someone couldn't throw away, and it's your kid, and then here you are dying and they don't care. It's like, it just makes you think twice, like don't take it so serious, you know. It was hard for me.
Do you think you're attracted to difficult material?
No, I did a couple of Muppet movies. Which is actually more difficult than you think.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Well, especially if you have to sing and dance with Danny Trejo.
I need to rewatch those. Another one of my favorite performances of yours, and favorite films actually in a long time, is The Place Beyond the Pines in 2012, which I just adore this movie. I think I've seen it 10 times. The structure of the movie was, of course, sort of a triptych. You know, there's three pieces to the narrative. Shot for low budget. Derek C. in France was the director. Did you have a sense of what that movie would look like, the end result? Because it is such an odd construct, but, and you know, Ryan Gosling dies at the beginning. I mean, it's just really nothing that you think it's going to be. What was it like to make that movie, and did you have a sense of his artistic vision while you were working with him?
No, not really. And I was pissed off because they cut out a lot of my good scenes. But no, that's partly joking. But it was a whole different thing. That, you know, it is three separate stories. So it's just a matter if that is your flavor or not, or like which play, you know, that one I think I saw once, so I don't remember a lot of it. But yeah, it was a whole different, everyone was really, really good. It was just an odd structure.
Right, and maybe he didn't know what it was going to be until the end himself.
Yeah.
Which is very often. And that brings us to Shades of Blue, 2016, obviously premiered last year. Did you have any reservations about jumping into a series regular job? It's a lot of work. We were talking backstage about your compressed schedule and the amount of dialogue you're learning under short periods of time. What went into your decision to say yes to this?
I saw how the business was changing and how the independent movies that I was doing a lot of were becoming less and less. And the tentpole movies were getting, there was more and more of that. And my age was getting more and more of that. So I thought, They were picking a lot of people. When I started in the 70s, if you were on a television show, you were kind of like out to pasture, you know, it was like towards the end. And now the whole thing has changed where if you're doing a television show with the right people, it's exhilarating and fun. So I definitely was leaning towards wanting to do a 13 episode, not a 20 two or 26, because I still wanted to try to do movies. And this came along. Really, the biggest thing that sold me was that Barry Levinson was going to shoot the pilot. Jennifer, I didn't know anything about aside from who she went out with. And I didn't see the, I don't mean that as a put down. I just didn't know her music.
You didn't know her as an actor.
Or as an actor. And she was more romantic comedies of what she was doing. So that was iffy, but it was also, she was the whole reason why the thing happened. We were 13 episodes right from the start. And it turns out she's great in it. She's great, and she's one of the most disciplined and literally one of the hardest working people in showbiz. She's got her fingers in a lot of things. So I'm really glad that I made the decision to do it. But yeah, it's work. And we shoot two shows at once, which is ridiculous. But.
Well, you're doing it, so that's all that matters. And it looks like you have embraced social media. You're on Twitter, which is exciting.
It's thrilling.
Well, I like, you posted a photo recently of you sitting in the Goodfellas diner, and you had just shot a scene for Shades there, which I thought was cool, you looking out the window, and that must have been a strange full circle moment to find yourself shooting in the same location, but all these years later in a very different show.
What happens, though, is there's somebody who takes the pictures, and then I'll just say something, and I'm of the school that I don't think the less you know about an actor, the better. I think. And now there's just too much of what they're, it's just too much. But I've also read articles that a lot of the studios, sometimes if it's between a couple people and somebody has a lot of looks or likes or whatever it is, then they could lean that way. So sometimes you got to play the game to beat them at the game. And so I'll do it in my way, in my sarcastic way. And also what I like doing best is celebrating the crew who go unrecognized, and on our show in particular, they're just great. Every camera guy, the DP, everybody is just really dedicated. So somebody will take a picture and it'll be with Stefan, our DP or whatever. And then I'll go on and talk about them and let them get. And then, so their family sees her or whatever. So I found a way to do
it. Sweet. Not a lot of actors take the time to do that. What's been your favorite day of shooting on Shades? A favorite scene or favorite location or favorite sequence?
Favorite day? I don't know about favorite day, but I think one of the most important days is what I think you showed, and that I really based the character, because all they tell you at first, because they don't know, is that I said something that set my daughter to the point of killing herself. So the they showed the confessional, right? That to me was the most important, and I didn't think it was going to hit me. I don't go into a scene saying, all right, I gotta cry today or something. I just kinda do the homework and then let whatever happens. And so your answer was, what was my favorite day?
Just memorable or just a bit.
Yeah, it would have been that, because it's really what I based from day one, that they finally let me verbalize, and the character had never really said
anything. Right, we learned a lot about him in that.
Yeah, and why Jennifer became so important to me as a daughter, because she got in trouble at the same time that my daughter passed away. And actually, this year we had a flashback of my daughter, and it's my daughter.
Your real daughter.
Yeah, my real daughter.
Aww. Well, I was going to ask about her because she is now 18. She's wanting to become an actor, or she is an actor and wanting to pursue it. How does it feel to see her following in your footsteps?
Who am I to say no? It's what she knew early on. She used to love coming to the set. She didn't care if she had to get up at 5 or stay till, well, she loved staying late. She showed that she really wanted to do it. In high school, she auditioned for every play. She just took it on herself. Like I didn't do anything in terms of introducing her to my agent. But it's really her wanting and her doing and taking the upper hand in it. So, you know.
Sounds like she's doing it for all the right reasons.
Yeah. She likes to play pretend. That's all she did when she was a kid.
Sweet. And when you're out in the world and people recognize you, what do people most frequently say to you, or is there a piece of feedback you've gotten from a fan that's really stuck with you about something you've made?
With Field of Dreams and what it's meant to a father-son relationship. Right. That, because usually it's kind of like a guy tearjerker, you know. That, they want me to say Karen.
just one word, Karen.
That it was the funny guy thing, but Karen's that seems to be the one right now.
And have you ever had a strange fan interaction where you've kind of had to be like, whoa, this person need to move along?
Well, some of the people that do it for a living,
right,
they get,
so
if they
crazy.
Don't get they get really nasty. They can get really nasty. So
I just, you give say, them that look that
no, I just say fuck you back.
And that ends up being like the best day of their life, by the way. And who are your heroes in the business? Either people you've worked with or people you grew up idolizing, or even people today you look at what he or she does as a writer, director, producer, and think, wow, I'd love to collaborate with that person.
Probably the ones who I mentioned when in the 70s that I was fortunate enough to work with, and that inspired me to want to be that kind of actor, to do like those kinds of movies, like Gene Hackman or Duvall or Anthony Hopkins and Vanessa Redgrave. I worked with, that was unbelievable. Some of the newer directors, I did this movie, Narc, with this guy Joe Carnahan, and I really liked that. Was it's nice to because I got into a little producing with that, was able to at that time. Would like to work with him again. There's so many people.
Not enough time for everybody to work together. What's your favorite way to spend time when you're not working?
Watching Family Guy. It's true. My daughter and I love watching Family Guy. It's our bonding. I'm a single dad, so we do all the talking, you know, up till dinner. So when we're at dinner, it's boom.
I'm sure Seth MacFarlane would be very happy to hear that.
No, he made fun of me twice.
He did?
Yeah. I said, Seth, I the first season, like nobody was watching your show. I did a voice. Then, like a couple years later, you're making fun of me, and he says, "Well, see, we're thinking about you."
That sounds like Seth. So we have quite a few good audience questions. So we're going to segue to that. Joe would like to ask you, what are your habits for preparing for a role? Are there types of methods or techniques that you have found work best for you?
It really depended on. In the beginning of my career, I was much, much, much more method. And I mean, obviously, to the point you're not going around killing people or but like if I was playing a surgeon, like I would go to open heart surgeries, like to the point where I would go so much that the doctor asked me to scrub up, and then then he asked me if I wanted to touch this woman's heart.
Oh my God!
And I almost said, "Oh God, I get to touch God," and so I did. I went down and touched this woman's heart. So I was like a big on preparation and knowing that it looks like it. And then as you get older, and the more that I studied, you realize it's pretend. You just pretend that you're doing it, and all the information that you need is in the script. So you could be the best non-butcher in the world. It doesn't matter if you're not saying what you need to say. So I mean, I still do some of it if you technically need to know, like for Field of Dreams, with, you know, to swing a bat, even though there's a whole story about why I didn't do it lefty than righty, but that was on them. and then it's just your imagination and then trusting yourself after doing it for like 35, 40 years now, you learn to trust what you've done because it's been proven in the past. And the more you get rid of actors' considerations, you know, saying other people's words on cue in front of people, it's all unnatural. But if you just put yourself in the head of just playing pretend, that set me free. That's what helped me. And that's really what I got from studying with Harry Master George.
That's great. I think is it Sana or Sarah? Excuse me, I couldn't realize. Sana, thank you. She would like to know, what feeds you as an artist? What inspires you?
Other artists, good movies. Like typical, almost silly, like a sunset, a beautiful view. Other actors, other, you know, movies that are like, you know, where people are extremely committed.
What was the last thing you watched that you thought was really great, movie-wise?
I'm so bad at that, at remembering names of movies.
Or maybe from this past Oscar season. Was there anything that you liked?
I don't know. I'll come back to that one. I know there's one, but I can't. I don't. There really is a few, but I can't think of it right now.
Okay, we'll come back. Crystal would like to know, when did you know that you had officially made it as an actor?
I still don't know. I do. There's a certain level that you want to get to, and that level for me is to work with the most committed people that with the most committed writing, with the best stories. It's all about the story and who you're working with. So, you know, when I first started, like I said, I wanted to do different parts, but that didn't necessarily mean that was a good thing for my career. And there's no question that I've been up and down. I've definitely had that career, and it's starting to ignite a little more now. So it's all relative, but now it's to be like, why aren't I in The Irishman, Marty? You know, you
did
still,
you actually ask
you
him
still
that?
Have that. No, but if he was here, I would.
Well, there's also a lot of great material being made now, too. So maybe actors feel, maybe actors are more inspired because there's just so much great stuff.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing. Josette would like to know, which of your performances has left the most lasting mark on you and transformed you as a result?
Wow, you guys are deep.
We weed out the bad questions. These are only the good ones.
I guess the ones like the ER one with death. As I'm getting older, obviously my parents have passed, and you understand and you realize what friendships really mean as you get older. You know, your relationship with your family, how important that is. So it would be something like that. Even this is really about, you think you're helping people, but you're also hurting people. And so that makes you think, like, why do that?
The Shades of Blue character.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of different things in that give me pause for thought.
And Lauren would like to know, switching gears a little bit, what was it like to work on Kimmy Schmidt with so many talented comedians and Tina Fey, specifically Titus, of course.
I met Tina. I hosted Saturday Night Live, and she wrote a great, great sketch where I wanted to be like a Barney character.
I remember that.
But I wanted to be the guy that was underneath Barney. So they had it where they had Rachel Dratch, is that how you say your last name? And she's endowed. And so I'm Barney, and they're dancing away, and she's dancing away and going up and down. And I take off the thing and say, we can't do this. It's anyhow, Tina wrote that. It was just really funny. Kimmy Schmidt was just, I just did it because I had worked with Tina. I worked with Tina on the Muppet movie. So.
And Titus, I'm sure.
But Kimmy, I don't know. I don't know what that show was about.
It's very absurd.
I can't wait to see it. Yeah.
It's very absurd. Vicky would like to know, do you take your dark characters home with you? When we sort of touched on that.
I did maybe more in the beginning, but less so now.
All right. Tom would like to know, is there something specific you haven't done that you want to? Is there a role, a character to play, or possibly direct or write?
I'd like to kiss the girl without having to choke her. I would like to do something more romantic, and maybe something like, I'm funny.
You're very funny.
Something more comedic and romantic.
Untapped potential. And Joey would like to know, or he says, or she, I know you act in commercials. We shared an agent in New York years ago. Do you tweak your approach to a role according to the medium? It's a good question.
Do I tweak?
Tweak your approach to a role according to the medium, whether it's film, TV, commercials.
No. Okay. No. It's all the same. It's making an audience feel like what they're watching is happening, and hopefully forgetting their day for 2 hours and that they're absorbed in the story, whether it's selling tequila for a minute or watching a show for an hour or a movie. I mean, that's the ideal. It doesn't happen much, but the ideal in what we do is to make the beginning and the end keep you just absorbed in that.
And finally, this group always likes to have some parting wisdom from our guests. Do you have any advice to share? People who are varying stages of acting careers, but is there one piece of advice maybe you wish you had known before you started?
No, I took mine. Really, when someone asked me, is to study. What we use is our imagination. The imagination is like a muscle. The more you exercise it, the stronger it's going to get. And no matter what you're doing, whether it's playing with your grandkid, your kid, or going to class and doing it. It's all about strengthening that muscle. And it could be at any age, you know. If anything, it's better to strengthen it as you get older.
Thank you so much for being here. Thank you, guys.
Thank you for listening to the SAG-AFTRA Foundation's Conversations podcast. If you appreciated what you heard, please support us with a review or donation and reach out to us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at SAG-AFTRA Found. We'd love to hear from you.